Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
The Taliban's will be judged for what their deeds are, not their words.
But until then, they still stand to get $1 billion from the G20 to help the Afghan people. Also ahead,
we have to be willing to bear witness, to the often painful realities that we would just rather not confront.
Why black women's complaints are rarely taken seriously. I'm joined by Kimberly Crenshaw, the leading scholar who coined the term intersectionality between race, gender, and class. Plus,
I would have recommended that he leave a force there. Had I been president, I would have left a small force there.
Stanley McChrystal, the American general who led international forces in Afghanistan, talks to Walter Isaacson. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. Afghanistan is headed into a full-blown humanitarian and economic crisis. The country, which is home to 38 million people, is running out of food and money, and also its health system is collapsing. This week, G20 nations announced pledges of more than $1 billion to help the Afghan people. But to distribute that, they'll have to work with the ruling Taliban. Of course, many of those countries spent the last 20 years fighting the Taliban. An awkward fact, the Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi acknowledged as he chaired that G20 meeting.
It's very hard to see how one can help the Afghan people, which is a big number. And Afghanistan is a big country without some sort of involvement of the Taliban government. I mean, if they don't want us to enter, we don't enter.
The United States says it's been having productive talks with Taliban officials in Doha as they try to figure out a way forward on aid. The Biden administration making clear that it wants to provide assistance directly to the Afghan people. I say making clear, but there are no details on how that would happen. Joining me now to explain is Fawzia Kofi, a former Afghan politician who was part of the team that negotiated with the Taliban before its takeover. And from Kabul, we're joined from and by Mary Ellen McGroarty. She's the World Food Programme Director for Afghanistan. Ladies, welcome to the programme. Can I start by asking you, Mary Ellen McGroarty, since you're on the ground there dealing with this humanitarian crisis, how bad is it? What are we talking? Is food running out? Are there substantial numbers of people who face famine or starvation, as we've been led to understand?
Good evening, Christiana from Kabul. Yeah, the situation in Afghanistan is accelerating and magnifying at an incredible pace. We already had a dire humanitarian situation before August, and now with the economic meltdown that's occurring, in addition to the drought situation, the legacy of COVID and conflict, people are just being pushed to the brink of survival. Jobs are being lost. Food prices are going up. Fuel prices are going up. And people just can't feed themselves.
Well, you know, Jan Egeland, as you know, who's the Secretary General of one of the biggest organizations, the Norwegian Refugee Council, has said the desperation is everywhere. Mothers I sat down with in makeshift tents told me their families have no income and no reserves, and they're worried that their children will starve and freeze to death this winter. So again, Mary Ellen, are you seeing any way that aid could come in? When you see what the G20 has pledged, does that make you feel good, or are there huge administration hurdles before you can get the food that's necessary?
I just want to confirm what Diana said. I've been out across the country and I've seen exactly the same scenes from women and young children sick from malnourishment. Yes, aid can come in. I mean, the humanitarian assistance and the humanitarian funding can come in to organisations like WFP. We're here on the ground along with our sister UN agencies, you know, with the staff and with the capacity to scale up the response. So it can come in and we stand ready to deliver. We have been here throughout the crisis. Our trucks are on the road across the country.
So Fawzia Koofi, let me talk to you in Doha there, which is kind of the centre of whatever talks internationally are being held with the Taliban and the political leadership there. What do you think of the G20 donor conference and the pledges that have been made? Do you think that the technicalities, as Mario Draghi said, can be overcome of dealing with the Taliban to get this distributed?
It is a very difficult situation, Christian, because on one hand you have a 35-plus population which have not been paid for months, the staff salary. People were already under poverty, more than 50% on under poverty line, with lack of any program or government program being offered to them in the last, even before, but in the last 2 months since the new power has taken shape in Kabul, the situation has become deteriorating because people are not paid, poverty is there, you know, people have lost jobs. Especially it becomes more difficult for women because women do not work, basically. So, but on the other hand, you have a situation where if, you know, the line is very narrow, one has to really struggle how to find it so that it does not really empower the ruling power in Kabul. Because my major concern is, yes, people, they need to be supported because they are people. And when I talk to you, Christian, those people and their faces with whom on daily basis I'm in contact or in front of my eyes, I already can imagine them. On one hand, you have them, which are even, you know, not earning $1 per day. On the other hand, you have a group that could use this humanitarian aid to boost their political position even more.
Well, that is the dilemma. It really is a huge dilemma. But clearly, the ethical thing is to get life-saving aid to the people. So, you know, I said you're in Doha. You're actually in Geneva, Switzerland. But when you left Kabul, you said the city looked like a graveyard full of people who were actually alive. I want to just play so we understand the gravity of what you're both telling us from an unemployed man in Kabul right now.
I came here to go with someone who needed a laborer. I used to be a government employee and worked at the Darul Aman Palace. My life was good, and I was receiving my salary, but now it is different. For 2 months now, most people have been unemployed and there are no job opportunities. We wander to find a piece of bread.
So again, let me ask you, Mary Ellen, I mean, you know, you're seeing that your staff and you are having to deal with this. You're there now. How are the Taliban treating you as an aid organization? What are they saying to you? Do they recognize that there's this massive humanitarian crisis? Do they care?
I mean, I think they recognize that there is a massive humanitarian crisis. I mean, we are getting access across the country. It's not completely homogenous, but we are able to move. We are negotiating with them so that we can bring access to the most vulnerable people. And what I'm seeing and what I'm experiencing so far is that we are getting that access and they appreciate, especially with the impact of the drought and the impact of the economic meltdown that's coming together and just the very visible signs of desperation that we're seeing right across the country at the moment.
So, you know, when the US says that it has raised the possibility of trying to, you know, get aid directly to the Afghan people, how do you get aid directly to each individual person or family, Mary Ellen?
Yeah, we work right across the country. We have offices across the country. We work with a huge range of partners who go into the very communities that we are serving and bring it directly to those communities. We're going directly to the communities.
Okay, but that goes through you. Let's be clear. It goes through an organization, right? Okay.
Yeah.
Let me clarify then with you, Fawzia Koofi. From what you know, what are the the state of any political talks between the United States, other international partners, and the Taliban right now on a range of issues, not just the humanitarian crisis, but also on the issues that they have said are their red line issues. Girls going to school, respecting human rights, you know, obviously the terrorism issue and keeping it a terrorist-free zone. What is the state of negotiations, Fawzia, as far as you know?
Well, I think a line of communication is important for the world to set conditions and to make their conditions clear in terms of inclusivity, because the government right now, the government that the power in Kabul establishes is by no means inclusive. They need to make it clear to them that without girls being in school and women being in workplace and respect for liberties and freedom of speech, you know, there will be not a blank check to them again. But I don't buy this idea of, you know, fighting one military extremist with another military extremist. In this case, fighting Daesh via Taliban or through Taliban wouldn't make sense, because you need to really build institutions, strong state building, and promote education, promote civilization to tackle a military extremist group. Because at the end of the day, probably after the fight between Taliban and Daesh, you might have one defeat the other one, but you don't have peace and stability in the region. So that is not going to respond positively. But in the meantime, it's important that the line of communication is kept for Taliban to understand what the world wants. And I think the expectation of people in Afghanistan, especially the women of Afghanistan, is that the world continue to use their leverage for the rights of women, because after 20 years, Christian, for us to talk about the rights to education is heartbreaking. Honestly, mm-hmm. as a woman, it's heartbreaking for us to see that we are still struggling for our right to go to school. Also, when it comes to humanitarian aid, I think we need to showcase in terms of women's participation from the decision-making, Afghan local women participation in the aid distribution and decision-making from top to bottom. Women need to be part of it. The aid should be, you know, distributed impartially without any Taliban making the decision on where the aid should go and where it should not go, because it has to reach the vulnerable people. And that is the main objective of these of the aid.
You know, let's be brutally frank, Fawzia. You've been, you know, working on this issue for a long, long time. And as you said, yes, rolling back the clock is heartbreaking. But, you know, is it just a fantasy to think that what you say can actually happen today, that women should be part of negotiation? Of course they should, but the Taliban aren't even allowing them to go to work, much less to school. Let us play just this soundbite, you know, from one little girl who still, despite Taliban pledges, cannot go to school.
I'm a seventh grade student. The Taliban will not allow girls above sixth grade to go to school, so I work on the street and earn 60 to 70 Afghani a day to buy food because my father is jobless.
Okay, so, you know, that number of Afghani's local currency amounts to about 70 cents a day. That's like nothing. I mean, Fawzia, how do you suggest the United States today, which has basically lost the war in Afghanistan, Taliban is back where it was 20 years ago, how does it use any leverage? What leverage does it have to get anything done right now?
I think the world still has a leverage to use, political and economical leverage. What the Taliban do in Afghanistan, we all know, actually, at this stage, does not represent Islam. Look what happened in the rest of Muslim countries. In the same country that hosts Taliban for many years and hosts the negotiation for more than a year, Qatar, it's 12% of more girls into school and universities than the boys. So I think what Taliban represent is not actual Islam. And therefore, I think the Muslim countries have a role to play. The OIC member states have a role to play. I think the world still can use their leverage if they really want, sincerely, through conditioning it to the Taliban. They can clearly say that we will only work with you if you map out a clear roadmap in terms of, you know, women's rights, girls' education, because it is not what they claim is not actually Islamic. So the Muslim world should come out and make a statement, because I think this is eventually also challenged their own societies, because Taliban have inspired many military extremist groups in the region and beyond. So tomorrow in their own borders, in the rest of Muslim world, other religious extremist groups could come out and could claim the same cause. And therefore, it's a common responsibility that we stand for actual true Muslim rights for women of Afghanistan and for men, I would say, in this case. And I think the United States, given their link in the region through the Gulf states, through the neighboring countries, they can use their leverage for a better. And even the EU, I mean, $1 billion with the previous committed aid to the UN is now $2 billion to the UN. This is all the leverage we could use for showcasing. Like for instance, in the humanitarian aid, we need to make sure that there are women in every stage of this process. There are women organizations that are being supported. There are, teachers could be paid still. It doesn't have to be through the establishment in Kabul. It could be directly to the teachers through their bank accounts. There are all means that we could do. We need to work out a mechanism that it is not, benefiting the power in Kabul, but in the meantime, the people could benefit that.
When you hear all this, and I know you're not political, Mary Ellen McGrory, but when you hear all this, what do you think? It's clearly, we understand that they have to be held accountable and not go back, which they are doing right now, to the way they were behaving back in the late 90s. But on the other hand, you've got a constituency, like half the country, that is on the edge of total destitution. What do you think when you hear what Fauzia is rightly saying and this ethical dilemma about trying to hold the Taliban accountable?
Christina, I think it's incredibly and desperately sad as a woman myself here in Afghanistan. But at the moment, what we're looking at across the country and seeing how the millions of innocent people, particularly the women and children, are currently suffering, we need to separate the humanitarian imperative from the political discussions. I think there are other levers that can be used against the Taliban, but at the moment we need to focus as humanitarian agencies on pulling people back from the brink of the incredible destitution and despair and hunger that's sweeping across the country.
And just quickly to you, Mary Ellen, winter is upon us, and certainly it will be very harsh, as always, in Afghanistan. What might we see in the next few months?
I think we're really going to see people struggling, to feed themselves and keep themselves warm. You know, I was just in Kandahar this week and they were telling me that the price of gas has doubled, for a kg from 40 Afghans to 80 Afghans for a kg. And that's playing out right across the country. We're going to see really, children continue to fall into severe malnourishment and families continue just to be on the very brink of hunger. And we need to do as much as we can to avoid that happening.
And Fauzia, again, you have left the country. I don't know whether you go back and forth, but how do you feel about what's happening now after all the, you said it's tragic that 20 years later we're talking about girls' education. And you were a lawmaker and then a negotiator. What do you feel you can do for your country now from outside?
Well, my plans, as you know, are to go back to Afghanistan and stand with those women who are protesting every day, risking their lives in the streets of Kabul and other provinces. So I'm not here for long term. But in the meantime, the time that I'm here, I spend it meeting political leaders, world leaders and institutions around the world, including European countries. And I was briefing the Security Council, UN Security Council yesterday, meeting with political leaders to set certain conditions, and the conditions should be based on the ground realities. I'm not here to talk about theoretical lessons. What I'm here to talk about is basically what is needed on the ground. So what Taliban, in fact, that in some parts of Afghanistan, in some provinces, the schools were opened by the local commanders. So soon sooner or later, this, you know, evolution where people from the local ground will be under pressure to respond to the demand of people. Mm-hmm. The Taliban in Kabul must listen to that. And I think the world will eventually have to listen and put more pressure. So what I tell to the world leaders is that they have to really make their conditions strong. In the meantime, yes, there is a segregation between humanitarian need and political pressure, but humanitarian aid is something which is essential, goes to my people. My heart actually, Christian, bleeds when people call me on daily basis asking for $10 support. Can you believe these are highly educated people with dignity and talent? They don't have even $10 per month. That is only the situation that people there could describe. But in the meantime, if this goes like that, a blank check, it can empower them. We talked about this. So therefore, I think what my message to the world leader was and to the world leader continue to be is that they need to make their conditions stronger and get engaged with Taliban in a means of communication for Taliban to respect those or slowly come to this understanding that they are facing a completely different Afghanistan, a very empowered nation that they have to respect and adopt based on what they want.
It's really a heartbreaking and fascinating story to see how it develops. Fawzia Koofi and certainly Mariella McGroarty, good luck to you there, and thank you very much indeed for joining us. And next, we focus on the United States' domestic struggles, particularly the issues of racism and sexism. My next guest, the Columbia Law professor Kimberly Crenshaw, has become world-renowned for her work on where those paths cross. Preeminent in her field, she coined the term intersectionality back in 1989. In a recent essay for the New York Times entitled How R. Kelly Got Away With It, Crenshaw argues that the R&B star, recently convicted of sex trafficking and racketeering, was able to dodge justice for so long because of a societal disregard for black girls and women. And she's joining me now from New York. Welcome to the program. It's good to see you, and your article was really fascinating. It's good to have you. So, look, you know, react to the verdict a little bit more and lay out what really is, you know, a staggering situation that this all happened in plain sight for so long. And because it was, you know, black women who were the victims, it simply wasn't taken seriously.
Yes. Well, you know, of course, it's a cause to be thankful that justice has finally been served, but it's not a moment for celebration. After all, this was not a whodunit. The question was, does anybody care? R. Kelly had used black women and girls as props. He had consumed them in full view of everyone. He even called himself the Pied Piper, both literally and materially. He used his music to attract, to pursue, to use, to abuse black women and girls. And everybody knew about it. So this isn't a question about something that folks just found out about. It wasn't a grand discovery. What shifted was the fact that there was a movement primarily put forward by African-American women and joined by women who finally had some power to be able to bring him to justice. So while we should be happy that finally justice has been served, this is an opportunity for us to really think about why it took so long, what it was about these black women and girls that allowed jurors to say, you know, they didn't believe them. They didn't like the way they dressed. They disregarded everything they said. What was it about these victims that allowed superstars to continue to work with R. Kelly, music executives to continue to make deals with him, consumers to continue listening to his music? This is a part of a long history of the way in which black women's sexuality, black women's veracity, black women's vulnerability has been dismissed in our culture, in our politics, and in our society. This is an opportunity for us to really dig into it rather than pat ourselves on the back.
And yet you say and you point out when everybody asks, is this a tipping point moment? Is it a watershed moment? This conviction I'm talking about. You recently wrote, if the interplay of racism and misogyny that facilitates the abuse of black women and girls continues to be taken for granted as background noise, the opportunity to correct the wider historical wrongs that this shameful saga represents will pass. So right now, I'm going to ask you, how worried are you that this opportunity will pass, particularly in light of some extraordinary facts and figures, and that is that R. Kelly's music and sales and all the rest of it have seen a massive spike in profitability to him since the conviction. What does that tell you?
Yeah, there's so many dimensions of this that make me worry that once again, this will just be a blip. In the history of intersectional injustice, some of the challenges that black women face. So as you point out, R. Kelly is once again streaming a lot of his music because it's available on the platform for people to gain access to. So the music industry has not joined in a significant way in holding R. Kelly accountable. People are still consuming music that was basically produced in the midst of and while black women were being abused. And I'll broaden it to say that not only do we have to worry about the fact that accountability seems to be in short supply, at least as far as the music industry is concerned and consumers, but I'd say more broadly, the history out of which this vulnerability arises, the fact that black women's productive labor, sexuality, was mobilized and used to really build this country. I mean, we do have to think about the fact that this country's main property was property in slaves. Where did that come from? That was forced reproduction. And there had to be stereotypes that were developed about black women that justified and made it okay. There has never been a Juneteenth for black women. There's never been a moment where all of these stereotypes about their veracity, about their inability to say no, the fact that they're literally unrapeable, that has been a deep part of our history. And we've only begun to peel back and tell that story. And now we're doing it at a time where some people want to stop us from telling these histories, stop us from thinking about these issues in an intersectional way, actually make it illegal to teach people these things. And if it's illegal to teach people these things, it will eventually be illegal to research it, or at least it won't be productive to research it. And then that means you can't even think about it. So we're going in the opposite direction precisely at a time where we have an opportunity to move forward.
And I'm going to dive into that in a second. But first, I want to ask you and pick up on what you said. It's often black women and the black community, as you said, who are kind of forced into, these are my words, a conspiracy of silence when these things happen. And I spoke to Drew Dixon and Joan Morgan about, you know, their documentary On the Record about this. And they highlighted, you know, this double bind that so many black women face, you know, saying that they understand that the price we've been asked to pay to support the struggle of racism is, you know, is silence. Our issues can be discussed at some later point after everyone gets free, if discussed at all. Here's the rest of what she told me.
There's also the issue of this feeling about in our community about airing dirty laundry. So you don't let people outside of the community see the problems and the struggles, because there is a ongoing pressure to appear to the larger world as our best selves.
So that's really difficult when the community itself feels, you know, that if it steps out and calls out these crimes, that it's somehow a betrayal of the community. Am I right on that?
Well, this has been an ongoing problem that black women have faced for generations. And it's a problem that's frankly a product of the failure to tell the true stories about what the history of anti-racism is. We confronted that during the Clarence Thomas Anita Hill hearings, the anniversary of which just happened a couple of days ago. The reality is that so many people in the African-American community responded positively to Clarence Thomas's effort to frame Anita Hill's testimony as a high-tech lynching, in part because the story about how Black women have experienced sexual racism and fought against it as part of anti-racism is a history that is not told. So we know about the history of Ida B. Wells, for example, who led the first anti-lynching campaign. People understand that lynching is deeply tied to white supremacy. What they don't know is that she also advocated for Black women and talked about how actually lynching was just a projection upon African-American men of what was actually happening to Black women. We also don't know Rosa Parks. Rosa Parks, before she stood up against segregation, she stood up for Black women who were raped in the South and they never saw their assailants arrested. And sexual harassment itself. The early plaintiffs in sexual harassment cases were African-American women who understood that sexual abuse on their jobs was a form of discrimination. Now, none of these stories were stories that people knew. They weren't heard, basically because we haven't rehearsed how fighting against racism and fighting against misogyny for many Black women have always been one and the same. That's how we ended up with Clarence Thomas, frankly, on the Supreme Court. Feminists, anti-racists were separated in that moment because they didn't know the history. So this whole story about having to suppress our dirty laundry has contributed to the crises between anti-racism and feminism. The bill has become due now if we really look at the legacy of that hearing. All the things that were made possible because a coalition that should have understood this history together didn't have it, and so they were put at loggerheads with each other.
And as you mentioned, the high-tech lynching that Clarence Thomas said he was being subjected to then got picked up by supporters of R. Kelly and before that Bill Cosby as well. So I can see where you're going with that, but particularly I'm interested in what you're also saying about a lack of understanding of history. And so I want to get to critical race theory because I think that's where you're heading. And clearly that has become a buzzword that's been taken and just thrown around. You didn't invent the term, but you certainly coined it when you were at Harvard Law School many years ago. So tell us what you meant by it then and what you see happening to this term now and why.
Well, critical race theory itself is simply the study about how racism and racial power is not simply a matter of individual level prejudicial acts. Of course, prejudice and individual bias is part of the history and the legacy of racism in this country. But the broader, bigger, deeper picture is the way in which history still walks among us. History is embedded in our institutions and in what stories get told, how policies are enacted. So critical race theory was just one piece of a broader way of thinking about structural inequality. Now, the way critical race theory has been deployed by those who would rather blame the people who are saying it's a problem rather than addressing the problem that we have is that it's been used as a catch-all to try to denounce all efforts to say that we still have a racial problem in this country. So under the guise of critical race theory, some school districts have fired teachers for teaching Ta-Nehisi Coates. We've seen Martin Luther King being taken off of reading lists. We've seen stories about children having to struggle with segregation being denounced as critical race theory. So what this actually is an attempt to force a particular kind of narrative about American history. It's an attempt to create one story, a story story that is purely one of celebration, a story that says we can't talk about how an entire country was grounded in things like slavery, manifest destiny, genocide. These are all real policies that were legal at a particular point in time, and there are echoes of those policies still that walk with us. When we think particularly about how this moment with respect to Black women is going to play out, if we can't talk about things that have not yet really surfaced, we can't talk about the way that sexual racism has played out, we can't talk about the way that as a matter of law, Black women, sometimes a court said you can't really believe them because they're known to lie. If we can't talk about the legacies of these things, you can't name a problem, you can't solve a problem. And that's the dilemma that we're facing right now.
So obviously, the backlash against critical race theory, as you laid it out, reached its zenith with the president, President Trump, who issued all these guidelines against teaching racial awareness, anti-discrimination in the federal agencies. Obviously, Biden has revoked that now, and it's allowed clearly back again. But it's also, as you mentioned, and it's clearly a political campaign. And clearly, you know, we know that it was somewhat started by this guy, Christopher Rufo, who says, we've successfully frozen their brand, critical race theory, into the public conversation, and we are steadily driving up negative perceptions. We will eventually turn it toxic, as we have put all of the various cultural insanities under that brand category. So that's, you know, that's what they're doing, and those are your opponents. And do you have a method to confront that? Because it's a clear, you know, very clever and obviously successful political campaign.
Well, one thing that's important is that we connect the dots. People need to realize that the same people who support the big lie about the election, the same people who support the big lie about the virus, the same people who support the big lie about voting irregularities, who are trying to suppress the rights to vote in so many states, the same people who are opposing protest and trying to criminalize legitimate protests against all sorts of conditions, the same people who are trying to take away the right to choice, the right to abortion, the same people who are behind all of these pushbacks are the people who are behind the idea that to be anti-racist is to be racist. So it's important for Americans, it's important for people all over the world to know, you don't have to have a PhD in critical race theory to see what's going on here. This is a tried and true playbook. When you don't really have an agenda, when you basically are trying to tear apart the democracy, you want to deflect. You want to give people something else to get upset about. And so critical race theory has filled that bill. It is a part of a big lie. So our strategy, our hope, is to tell the truth, to tell people, you, if you understand race and racism, you are practicing critical race theory. When you get pulled over by a police officer and you are a Black person and you move very, very slowly and carefully, you are practicing critical race theory. When you go into a store and you are followed because you are African American, you are practicing critical race theory. It is simply an awareness that race still exists, that it shapes what happens to people, and they need to be aware of it in order to navigate the social terrain without some of the consequences that have befallen so many people. So the idea is to simply say race and racism are real. The only way that we're going to interrupt it and to dismantle it is to be able to face it bravely, truthfully, and without fear. Right. They're taking us in the wrong direction.
Professor Kimberly Crenshaw, thank you very much indeed for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
So, as the world also grapples with the humanitarian fallout in Afghanistan, as we discussed earlier, our next guest is watching it unfold, knowing all too well what's on the line. He is the former four-star U.S. General Stanley McChrystal, who was commander of American and coalition forces in Afghanistan. Drawing on this experience, his new book offers a user's guide to risk. And here he is talking with Walter Isaacson about the major global threats that are on his mind right now.
Thank you, Christian. And General Stan McChrystal, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Walter.
You have a new book called Risk a user's guide. You talk about flaws in our leadership today, and you say it really begins at the helm. Let's drill down on that. Let's talk about COVID. What flaws in leadership happened?
Yeah, they were huge, Walter. If you stop back and think about COVID, COVID is not an enemy that is 10 feet tall. It's something we should have been able to handle. One, we know that viral challenges like that come with relative frequency. Pandemics come. We also know public health pretty well. We have a history of that, experience in it. So we know that it's coming, it's inevitable, and we know what to do about it. And then we were aided by a scientific miracle, the fastest production of vaccines ever. And so if you line those three factors up, we should be having a celebration right now of how we fended off COVID-19. And we did it as a united country because this was an enemy everybody could hate. Nobody could be sympathetic to COVID-19. And yet that didn't happen. What instead happened is very early, we started having communication that was confusing. In some cases, it was contradictory. It was going to be incomplete because you don't know enough in an evolving situation. But instead of saying we don't know enough, we put out partial information and sometimes absolutely incorrect information, and we caused our society to go into tribes on that. Similarly, some of the actions you have to take. The thing about a pandemic is you have to act early. That means you have to act before it's apparent to the population just how bad the threat is. And that risks being unpopular because you have to spend money or take actions that are inconvenient or unpopular before people see thousands and thousands of people being sick because you have to get in front of it. But they didn't. They held off. They delayed. They waited until it was very, very obvious. And then in many cases, that's too late. But that's what we pay leaders for. That's what we select them for. And so we've got to look for that in our leaders.
Well, let's talk about right now. We're still debating mask mandates. We're still debating vaccine mandates. We're still making this partisan and political. You advise a lot of states. Tell us what we should do in this moment on COVID.
Yeah. Well, personal opinion, we need to mandate masks. We need to mandate vaccines. If you think about a military analogy, the common defense relies on a common set of people out there defending it. In this case, every American is part of that common defense. You can't have some soldiers do their job and others not do their job, or there's no coherent defense. To have a common defense against COVID-19, every American needs to do as much as they can. I think the mandate is the mask mandate is table stakes. I think the vaccine mandate is the same. I would advise the president now to take some steps like requiring vaccines to travel, to get on airplanes, to get on trains, to do the things. It sounds draconian, but you've got to make it inconvenient, very inconvenient to be unvaccinated because you are leaving a hole in the nation's defense when you don't.
Well, let's talk about the risks and the vulnerabilities that deal with China. And if China does something in Taiwan, what do you think the risk of that is? How should we prepare for it? And should we be prepared to go to war with China over Taiwan?
Well, the question you asked is a question that China is trying to get us to ask ourselves. So the Chinese strategy now over the last 72 years has been to increase their capability so that they make our implied security guarantee to Taiwan be very, very dangerous for us, expensive. There were for many decades, we could do it. We could counterstrike into China. And so if they did it, it would be theoretically much more painful for China than it would be for the United States. Their military improvements in the last couple of decades have made it so that it would be difficult, not impossible for us to do it, but it would be difficult. They've raised the stakes. For the sole purpose of getting you to table the question you just asked, do we really want to defend Taiwan? Do we really care? It's a long way away. None of my relatives live there, you know, whatever mindset you want to put. And if they can convince the United States that it's just not worth it, then suddenly a couple things will happen, that the population of Taiwan will feel much less guaranteed and secure, and they'll probably recalculate how they want to move forward. Also, our other allies in the region. I don't have a perfect answer for the question you just asked. I can't tell the president of the United States what the right answer is, but I can say that that's the question on the table. And the first thing we have to do is give ourselves as many options as possible. So the first thing, we need to make sure that our military capability gives us that option if we choose that. We can defend Taiwan if we want to. We can go head to head with the Chinese. But then we also have to build alliances in the region. We have to do all those other things, because if you don't have options, it's not really a question. You're just going to do whatever the Chinese say. If we have options, then we can have this discussion.
As the U.S. commander in Afghanistan in 2009, 2010, it must have been gut-wrenching for you to watch what happened in the past few months with our withdrawal and how it happened. How do you think that President Biden assessed the risks and the vulnerabilities in pulling out of Afghanistan this year?
Yeah, I certainly won't speak for President Biden, but from where I sat, President Trump's administration signed the Doha Accords. So there was an agreement in place that the United States would leave on date certain, 1 May 2021. So when President Biden came into office, he had two choices. He could abrogate that agreement and stay, in which case he accepts the risk of extending the forever war, which was not very popular in the United States and was very much against President Biden's very public position on the war. Or he could stick to the promise that we would pull all Americans out. He did delay it a bit, but he could do that. So that's a tough choice. Politically, he's going to get beat up either way. If he pulls out, they're going to say, you pulled out. And if ISIS or Al-Qaeda does it, he's going to be tagged with it, even though the war goes 20 years. If he doesn't, you know, he gets tagged for not being courageous and not having the courage to end the war. So tough decision. Then they make the decision to pull out. And there's been a lot of criticism of, you know, intelligence failure, this or that. Actually, this is tricky business. The danger was not as much the Taliban, because the Taliban were already incentivized not to attack Americans. But ISIS and Al-Qaeda, those who were in the country, were incentivized to do just that, to try to make us bleed. So I think the calculation, and I wasn't involved in it, was to try to extract the American force as quickly as you could to reduce the window of vulnerability to ISIS and Al-Qaeda attacks. And I don't think people saw that the government of Afghanistan and their military would collapse as quickly as they did. You could say that's an intelligence failure, but that was less a military calculation than a psychological calculation on the part of the Afghan people, who just lost confidence.
Do you think Biden made the right decision to pull out of Afghanistan this year?
Let me put it this way, Walter. I would have recommended that he leave a force there. Had I been president, I would have left a small force there. But I'm clearly biased. I mean, I've got part of my heart and soul in Afghanistan. I think President Biden made a courageous decision. And I think once he made that decision, the American people should line up behind that decision and say, okay, this is what we've decided to do. Admitting they were two tough courses of action. There wasn't an easy right and a stupid wrong. This was a tough one.
You poured so much of your heart and soul into Afghanistan. Just tell me personally what it was like to feel that this mission ended, it seems to me, in such a failure.
Yeah, it does. And it feels badly because many of us, me included, believed it was possible, believed that the Afghan people could build a society. And in many ways, I think they did. I watched progress. From 2001 on, the role of females in society, they have more females in their parliament than we do in our Congress. So many things improved, but they just couldn't get the legitimacy of the government, you know, to the point where it completely was credible to the Afghan people. So it was really heart-wrenching to see and to know that Afghanistan's young population particularly wants a different country. The Taliban are not a popular revolution that took over and suddenly met the desires of the people. And so there's a big part of the Afghan population that I think is very disappointed. So I share their disappointment and pain. What I don't want to have happen now is that the American people say, well, Afghanistan was impossible. It was the graveyard of empires. Nobody can succeed there. Therefore, you know, we just made a bad mistake going there. I think that lets us off the hook. I don't think it was impossible. I don't think it worked, partially because we didn't do everything we could have. We got some things wrong. And there are other players too. The Afghans share responsibility. The Pakistanis share responsibility. But the bottom line is our conclusion, in my opinion, should not be we can never do this kind of thing again, because we're going to have to help other nations again in the future. We just need to do it better.
Let's talk about the January 6th insurrection, because in your book you talk so much about the enemy is us in some ways. We've got to figure out what to do in our republic. Tell me how communications and technology led to that and the risks you see coming out of the January 6th uprising.
It will start first with communications. We, I believe, are a society that is ahead of ourselves technologically than we are in terms of maturity, meaning we have more technology than we are yet comfortable using. So we can communicate faster than we can think, and we usually do. We also have given opportunity for people who would leverage communication, because the cost of passing information is essentially zero now. And so there's no barrier to entry in how much communication you can pass. So someone who wants to leverage that to get people to do something, particularly people who are already misinformed or are open to being misinformed, is pretty dangerous. In the book, we describe Adolf Hitler. He literally just takes a series of very basic messages and hammers them. And the scary part is not that some fringe part of Germany followed Adolf Hitler. It's that massive parts of the German population did. And until the day he died in 1945, he was still relatively popular. And so the power of this should be daunting to us.
Well, wait, let me ask you, tell me about the parallels you see. Do you see a parallel with that?
Well, I do, because when people use the ability to inform and influence in a form of, I'll call it political opportunism, what they do is they leverage up people who are reliant upon pretty limited forms of input information in some cases. You can get them to do things that, like the January 6th insurrection. I don't believe that everybody who went to the Capitol was a bad person. I don't believe that they were racist. I don't believe that they were trying to do something they thought was wrong. And that's the part that should give us pause, because they did something that I view as extraordinarily wrong and dangerous, but they did it believing that they were doing something that was right.
So who was to blame for that?
I think it's the people who used the power. I think President Trump is at the top of that list, but he has an entire group of people around him, all of who have seen some benefit for themselves, either politically or otherwise, to align themselves and use that. And
I think what's the ongoing risk and vulnerability to our society coming out of January 6th?
Well, a fragmentation of our society. I think we come out of January 6th. It should, just like COVID-19 should have been the ultimate unifying factor, January 6th should have been a wake-up call. It should have been like getting cold water dumped on us and say, wait a minute, what are we doing? We need to stop. We need to sober up. We need to do whatever we have to do to come back to some kind of rational political discourse at the highest levels. People are in the political sphere. And then the rest of us have need to get out of some of our tribal camps and we start to interact. And the danger is, I think, in the aftermath, we haven't done that.
At the recent rally in Des Moines, former President Trump insisted that he won the 2020 election and he won a whole lot of the states, which is, of course, incorrect. Does that concern you that it's almost like a coup? And what do you expect for 2024?
I think first I'll answer it in two parts. First, Walter, I think we need to look at our processes and we need to very transparently communicate that to the American people so that the absolute facts, as best we can know them, are known to a number of officials and then potentially to every American. So the truth is out there. The reality is out there. Then the question is, how do we treat people who just claim something that isn't so? I think if a person propagates the big lie, and we've had the big lie propagated for years, American Tobacco refined the process for decades, and they did pretty well with it. And so we know how dangerous it is. We've got to have the courage to call it out. We've got to have the courage to say, that's just not true. And if you say things that are not true, you are, in all terms, a liar. And our society can't celebrate that. They can't say, yeah, that person's a liar, but they're a good person, or they do good things. I can't connect the two. You know, there's a lot of people say, don't pay attention to what a certain leader says, pay attention to what they do, because what they do is good, what they say doesn't count. I think what they say matters, because if you can't pay attention to that, how do you know what they're going to do? And so I think this is a societal norm issue, and it's one we're going to have to all take on.
But it comes down to the question that, as a military person, you know very well, which is collaborationism, people who are tempted to collaborate. And you have a lot of Republican senators, people you know, and congressmen from Leader McCarthy to Senator Graham, who just seem to go along with it. How dangerous are the people, including Republican leaders, who collaborate in this big lie?
Well, I think to the degree any of us is tempted to collaborate, we become dangerous, even more so because we give credibility to it. I would give a quote that I believe was used by Senator Cruz some years ago. He said, history will not be kind to the people who held Mussolini's coat.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think history is going to be really hard on those of us who don't stand up to our values when we know what's actually right.
General Sam McChrystal, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Walter.
Such important reminders. And finally, on another major important existential issue, of course, and that is protecting our wildlife. Now, from reindeer locking antlers to playful polar bears, these are some of the winning images from this year's Wildlife Photographer of the Year. The competition was developed by the Natural History Museum here in London. And there was a record 50,000 entries from 95 countries. And French underwater photographer Laurent Balesta has taken the top prize with his photo of camouflage groupers here, leaving behind clouds of eggs and sperm. They are a species of marine fish that are found in French Polynesia. In other categories, winners include this curious grizzly bear, a pair of courting ravens, and this mountain gorilla who seems to be enjoying the rain. A peaceful sight there. And with that reminder of how special our wildlife is, that is it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thanks for watching, and goodbye from London.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.